The Great Second Advent Movement by J.N. Loughborough, Chapter 16, The Third Angel's Message. The third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If any man worship the beast in his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus." Revelation 14, verses 9 through 12. The most solemn warning in the Bible. This is the most solemn warning that the Bible contains. And it is certain that the record of our world's history presents no testimony that this message has been heard in the past. The fact that the first and the second angels of this series have been proved to belong to the present generation most clearly establishes the point that this message does not belong to past ages. Said Elder J.V. Himes in 1847, quote, "The 14th chapter of Revelation presents an astounding cry, yet to be made, as a warning to mankind in that hour of strong temptation," verses 9 through 11. A denunciation of wrath so dreadful cannot be found in the book of God besides this. Does it not imply a strong temptation to require so terrific an admonition? Close quote. Facts on Romanism, page 112. The temple opened, the ark seen. J.N. Andrews said of this message, quote, "The opening of the holiest of all in the temple of heaven by which the ark is seen is an event that takes place under the sounding of the seventh angel. And as the ministration of our great high priest is changed to that apartment at the termination of the 2300 days, we understand that the opening of the temple is marked by the termination of that period as represented by the proclamation of the first angel. The entrance of our high priest to the most holy place to minister before the ark of God calls the attention of the church to the commandments of God contained with that ark. The commandments of God have been shining out from the heavenly sanctuary since that time." Change of the Sabbath. It is a fact, beyond dispute, that the fourth commandment, some ages since, was changed from the rest day of the Lord to the pagan festival of Sunday. This change was made in express contradiction of the Holy Scriptures, which everywhere recognizes the seventh day as the only weekly Sabbath of the Lord. It was accomplished by the great apostate who Daniel predicted should think to change times and laws. This power is essentially the same as the beast which was to be worshipped by all the world. And it is a fact of deep interest that this commandment, which has been so long trodden down, is now being vindicated, and the people of God are beginning to keep it with the other nine. Thanks be to God that He is preparing the remnant for their final conflict with the dragon and for admittance through the gates into the holy city. Revelation 12, verse 17, chapter 22, verse 14. The vindication of the fourth commandment in opposition to the Sabbath of the apostasy and the preaching of all the commandments of God is a striking testimony that the presence is the period of the saints' patience and the warning of the third angel, close quote. the Three Angels of Revelation 14, 6 to 12, pages 131 and 132. Attention has been called in previous chapters to the first and second of these messages as fulfilled in the Great Second Advent Proclamation down to October 22, 1844. The scripture at the opening of this chapter reads, quote, "The third angel follows them," close quote. That is, followed the first and second angels. It will perhaps be of interest in this connection to call attention to the rise of the third angel, the first Adventist Sabbath keepers. During the Midnight Cry in 1844, the Lord began to lead the minds of his people to the keeping of the seventh-day Sabbath. This doctrine among Adventists arose on this wise. Rachel Preston, a Seventh-day Baptist, moved to Washington, New Hampshire, where there was a church of Adventists. She accepted the Advent doctrine, and that church, composed of about 40 members, through her missionary labors, accepted the Sabbath of the Fourth Commandment. Rachel Preston died at Vernon, Vermont, February the 1st, 1863, at the age of 59 years. This led to inquiry upon that subject. In the cry of September 5, 1844, we read, quote, "Many persons have their minds deeply exercised respecting a supposed obligation to observe the seventh day," close quote. This statement was contained in an editorial in which a faint effort was made to establish the claims of Sunday keeping. The subject was continued in the number of September 12, where we find the following significant statement, which led to serious and close study by many. The seventh day, the only law-appointed day. Quote, "Last week, we found ourselves brought to this conclusion. There is no particular portion of time which Christians are required by law to set aside as holy time. If this conclusion is incorrect, then we think the seventh day is the only day for the observance of which there is any law," close quote. T.M. Preble's essay, "The attention of the Adventists as a body was called to the Sabbath question by an essay on the subject from T.M. Preble, dated February 13, 1845, and published in the Hope of Israel, Portland, Maine, February 28, 1845. After showing the claims of the Bible Sabbath and the fact that it was changed to Sunday by the great apostasy, he remarks, quote, "Thus we see Daniel 7:25 fulfilled, the little horn changing times and laws. Therefore, it appears to me that all who keep the first day for the Sabbath are the Pope's Sunday keepers and God's Sabbath breakers." Close quote, taken from Andrew's History of the Sabbath, page 506, edition of 1887. J.B. Cook on the Sabbath question. Soon after this, there appeared in print an article from J.B. Cook, in which he showed that there is no scriptural evidence for keeping Sunday as the Sabbath, and he used this terse expression, quote, "Thus easily is all the wind taken from the sails of those who sail, perhaps unwittingly, under the Pope's Sabbatic flag," close quote. Although Sabbath keeping by these two men was of short duration, they had set a ball rolling that could not easily be stopped. The catchphrases, "Pope's Sunday keepers," "God's commandment breakers," and "sailing under the Pope's Sabbatic flag," were on the lips of hundreds who were eager to know the truth of this matter. Elder Joseph Bates of Fairhaven, Massachusetts, had his attention thus arrested, and he accepted the Sabbath in 1845. Joseph Bates accepts the Sabbath. His experience was on this wise. Hearing of the company in Washington, New Hampshire, that were keeping the Sabbath, he concluded to visit that church and see what it meant. He accordingly did so, and on studying the subject with them, he saw they were correct, and at once accepted the light on the Sabbath question. On returning to New Bedford, Massachusetts, he met on the bridge between New Bedford and Fairhaven a prominent brother who accosted him thus, "Captain Bates, what is the news?" Elder Bates replied, "The news is that the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord our God." "Well," said the man, "I will go home and read my Bible and see about that." So he did, and when they next met, this brother had accepted the Sabbath truth and was obeying it. The first book on the Sabbath. Elder Bates at once began to preach this truth from state to state. He soon saw that a book, or even a tract, on the Sabbath question would be a great help to him in his work, and his soul was moved by the Spirit of God to write and publish something on this subject. But how could it be done without money was the question, as all that he had was a York shilling, that's 12.5 cents. It may be of interest to the reader to relate his experience in this matter, just as he told it to me in 1855. 4 pounds of flour. He said that while in prayer before God, he decided to write the book and felt assured that the way would open to publish it. He therefore seated himself at his desk with Bible and concordance to begin his work. In the course of an hour, Mrs. Bates came into the room and said, "Joseph, I haven't flour enough to make out the baking," and at the same time mentioned some other little articles that she needed. "Well, how much flour do you lack?" asked Joseph Bates. "About 4 pounds," was her reply. "Very well," replied he. After she had left the room, he went to a store nearby, purchased the 4 pounds of flour and all the other articles, brought them home, and again seated himself at his writing desk. Presently, Mrs. Bates came in and saw the articles on the table and exclaimed, "Where did this flour come from?" "Why," said the captain, "isn't there enough? You said you wanted 4 pounds." "Yes," said she, "but where did you get it?" "Oh, I bought it," said he. "Is not that the amount you wanted to complete the baking?" "Yes," continued Mrs. Bates, "but have you, Captain Bates, a man who has sailed vessels out of New Bedford to all parts of the world, been out and bought 4 pounds of flour?" "Yes." "Was not that the amount you needed to complete the baking?" "Yes," said Mrs. Bates, "but have you bought 4 pounds of flour?" $11,000 spent for the truth. Another trial soon followed. When Captain Bates left the sea, he sold out his interest in a ship for $11,000, but now he had spent his all to advance the cause of truth. Up to this date, Mrs. Bates did not know his true financial condition, but he felt that he must now acquaint her with it, so he calmly said, "Wife, I spent for those articles the last money I have on earth." With bitter sobs, Mrs. Bates inquired, "What are we going to do?" The captain arose, and with all the dignity of a captain directing his vessel, said, "I'm going to write a book. I'm going to circulate it and spread this Sabbath truth before the world." "Well," said Mrs. Bates, through blinding tears, "what are we going to live on?" "Oh, the Lord is going to open the way," was Captain Bates' smiling reply. "Yes," said Mrs. Bates, "the Lord is going to open the way. That's what you always say." And bursting into tears, she left the room. An unexpected supply. After Captain Bates had continued his work for a half an hour, the impression came to him to go to the post office, as there was a letter there for him. He went, and sure enough, there was a letter. In those days, the postage on letters was 5 cents, and prepayment was optional. The writer of this letter had for some reason failed to pay the postage. And here again Captain Bates was humbled, as he was obliged to tell the postmaster, Mr. Drew, with whom he was well acquainted, that he could not pay the postage as he had no money, but he said, "Will you let me see where it is from?" "Take it along," said the postmaster, "and pay some other time." "No," said the captain, "I will not take the letter out of the office until the postage is paid." While he had the letter in his hand, he said, "I'm of the opinion that there is money in this letter." And turning to the postmaster, he asked, "Will you please open it? If there is money in it, you can take the postage out. If not, I will not read it." Well, the postmaster complied with his request, and lo, it contained a $10 bill. He found by reading that the letter was from a person who said the Lord so impressed his mind that Elder Bates was in need of money that he hastened it to him, and in the haste, he probably forgot to pay the postage. After paying the postage, he went to a provision store, bought a barrel of flour for $4, besides potatoes, sugar, and other necessary articles. When giving orders where they were to be delivered, he said, "Probably the woman will say they don't belong there, but don't you pay any attention to what she says. Unload the goods on the front porch." He then went to the printing office and made arrangements for publishing 1,000 copies of a tract of about 100 pages, with the understanding that as the copy was furnished, the printers were to put it in type as rapidly as possible, sending proofs to him. He was to pay for the work as fast as he received the money, and the books were not to be taken from the office until the bills were all paid. Captain Bates knew well there was no money due him, but he felt it his duty to write this book, believing that the Lord would move on the hearts to send the money when it was needed. After purchasing paper, pens, etc., thus giving time for the household supplies to go in advance of him, he went to the head of the street leading to his house. On seeing that the articles were there, he went into the house by the back entrance and seated himself again at his desk. Mrs. Bates came in and said excitedly, "Joseph, just look out on the front porch. Where did that stuff come from?" "A drayman came here and would unload it. I told him it didn't belong here, but he would unload it." "Well," said Captain Bates, "I guess it's all right." "But," said Mrs. Bates, "where did it come from?" "Well," said the captain, "the Lord sent it." "Yes, Mrs. Bates, the Lord sent it. That's what you always say." He then handed the letter to his wife, saying, "Read this, and you will know where it came from." She read it, and again retired for another cry. But it was of a different character from the first, and on returning she humbly asked his pardon for her lack of faith. Money coming for the book. As the work of writing and printing progressed, Captain Bates received money from time to time through the mail and otherwise, sometimes from persons he had never met. As he received the money, it was passed over to the printers and applied on the book account. Finally, the day came when the books were all printed, and from a source unexpected by Brother Bates, the balance of the account was met. Thus, the books were not delayed even a day in their circulation. Last bill paid. H.S. Gurney of Memphis, Michigan, told me in March of 1884 that he, on the very morning Elder Bates's book was completed, received $100 on an outlawed note from a man who declared he would never pay him. Having received this money, he esteemed it a pleasure to spend a portion of it in paying the last bill on the Sabbath tract of Elder Bates. "But," said Mr. Gurney, "Brother Bates never knew to the day of his death who paid the balance of the book bill." This experience of Elder Bates in printing the Sabbath truth seemed to say to our people from the very beginning of publishing the truth on the Sabbath question, "Go forward in this line of work and expect God's providence to open the way as you advance." Elder Bates, skeptical of the visions. The following statement, abridged from Life Sketches, will show how the gift of prophecy and the Sabbath reform were united. While on a visit to New Bedford, Massachusetts in 1846, Miss Harmon became acquainted with Elder Joseph Bates. He had early embraced the Advent faith and was an active laborer in the cause. He was a true Christian gentleman, courteous and kind. He treated Miss Harmon as tenderly as though she were his own child. The first time he heard her speak, he manifested deep interest, and after she had ceased, he arose and said, "I am a doubting Thomas. I do not believe in visions. But if I could believe that the testimony the sister has related tonight was indeed the voice of God to us, I should be the happiest man alive. My heart is deeply moved. I believe the speaker to be sincere, but I cannot explain in regard to her being shown the wonderful things she has related to us." Miss Harmon accepts the Sabbath. Elder Bates was keeping the Sabbath and urged its importance. Miss Harmon did not at that time feel its importance and thought Elder Bates erred in dwelling upon the fourth commandment more than upon the other nine. But the Lord gave her a view of the heavenly sanctuary. The temple of God was opened in heaven, and she was shown the ark of God with the mercy seat covering it. Two angels stood, one at either end of the ark, with their wings spread over the mercy seat and their faces turned toward it. This, her accompanying angel informed her, represented all the heavenly host, looking with reverential awe toward the law of God which had been written by the finger of God. Jesus raised the cover of the ark, and she beheld the tables of stone on which the Ten Commandments were written. She was amazed as she saw the fourth commandment in the very center of the ten precepts, with a soft halo of light encircling it. The angel said, "It is the only one of the ten which defines the living God who created the heavens and the earth and all the things that are therein. When the foundations of the earth were laid, then was also laid the foundation of the Sabbath." She was shown that if the true Sabbath had been kept, there would have never been an infidel or an atheist. The observance of the Sabbath would have preserved the world from idolatry. The fourth commandment had been trampled upon. Therefore, we are called to repair the breach in the law and to plead for the downtrodden Sabbath. The man of sin, who exalted himself above God and thought to change times and laws, brought about the change of the Sabbath from the seventh to the first day of the week. In doing this, he made a breach in the law of God. Just prior to the great day of God, a message is sent forth to warn the people to come back to their allegiance to the law of God, which Antichrist has broken down. Attention must be called to the breach in the law by teaching and example. She was also shown that the third angel of Revelation 14, proclaiming the commandments of God in the faith of Jesus, represents the people who received this message and raised the voice of warning to the world to keep the commandments of God and His law as the apple of the eye, and that in response to this warning, many would embrace the Sabbath of the Lord. This is found in Life Sketches, pages 95 and 96. This experience of Miss Harmon and Elder Bates was in harmony with the Lord's method of working. The attention of both Miss Harmon and Elder White was called to the Sabbath question by Elder Bates, who presented to them from the Scriptures the claims of the unchangeable law of God. Although Miss Harmon had been blessed with special manifestations from the Lord for about 18 months, nothing on this subject had been previously shown her. Now the Lord's time had come, as believers were being raised up to keep His law, to impart light to them through the gift of prophecy, and thus, by His own way of working, the third angel's message, the commandments of God, and the testimony of Jesus Christ were brought together. Beginning the third angel's message. From that time, the third angel's message, as connected with the other two, began to be proclaimed. The Sabbath truth as connected with the Ark of God and the light developing with reference to the sanctuary confirmed what had been previously shown, that the past Advent movement was right and in the order of the Lord. They could now understand more fully than ever before the meaning of the three steps up onto the pathway to the city of God. Elder Bates accepts the visions as from God. In the month of November 1846, a conference was held in Topsham, Maine, at which Elder Bates was present. At that meeting, Mrs. White, Miss Harmon's marriage to Elder James White, has been previously noticed, had a vision which was the cause of Elder Bates's becoming fully satisfied as to their divine origin. He was a man who had followed the sea for 50 years, filling all positions from cabin boy up to master and owner of vessels. His understanding of astronomy was such that, as he told me, he could tell very nearly where he was upon the sea as to latitude and longitude by his observation of the celestial bodies. Such a one would naturally be interested in talking about astronomy. In conversation with him, he told me how he became convinced of the divine origin of the visions. He said he tried to talk to Mrs. White one day about the stars, but he soon found out she knew nothing about astronomy. In fact, as she told him, she did not know as she had ever looked into a book treating on that subject. She had no inclination to converse upon that topic and turned the conversation by talking about the new earth and what had been shown her in vision respecting it, the opening heavens. In the previous year, April 19, 1845, the Illustrated London News had published something of great interest to astronomers from Lord Rosse respected the wonderful discoveries he had made through his monster telescope, especially a view of what astronomers call the gap in the sky. One evening, at the conference above mentioned, at the house of Mr. Curtis, and in the presence of Elder Bates, who was yet undecided in regard to these manifestations, Mrs. White, while in vision, began to talk about the stars, giving a glowing description of rosy-tinted belts which she saw across the surface of some planet, and added, "I see four moons." "Oh," said Elder Bates, "she's viewing Jupiter." Then, having made motions as though traveling through space, she began giving a description of belts and rings in their ever-varying beauty, and said, "I see seven moons." This is noted in Rise and Progress, and it says she saw eight moons to Saturn. This change was made after the proofs were sent out of my hands. More moons to both Jupiter and Saturn have since been discovered. Elder Bates exclaimed, "She's describing Saturn." Next, she said, "I see six moons," and at once began a description of the opening heavens with its glory, calling it an opening in a region more enlightened. Elder Bates said that her description far surpassed any account of the opening heavens he had ever read from any author. While she was talking and still in vision, he arose to his feet and exclaimed, "Oh, how I wish Lord John Rosse was here tonight." Elder White inquired, "Who is Lord John Rosse?" "Oh," said Elder Bates, "he is the great English astronomer. I wish he was here to hear that woman talk astronomy and to hear that description of the opening heavens. It is ahead of anything I've ever read on the subject." From that evening, Elder Bates became fully satisfied that the visions of Mrs. White were outside of her knowledge and control. This and the character of the reproof and instruction given satisfied him that they were from God. This phenomenon in the heavens thus described by Mrs. White in that vision is a matter rarely mentioned by astronomical writers. Huygens, the first discoverer of it, gives the following description, a glorious light in the sword of Orion. Quote, astronomers placed three stars close together in the Sword of Orion, where I viewed the middlemost with a telescope in the year 1656. There appeared, in the place of that one, 12 other stars. Among these, three at that almost touch each other, and four more besides appeared, twinkling as through a cloud, so that the space about them seemed much brighter than the rest of the heaven, which, appearing wholly blackish by reason of the fair weather, was seen as through a curtain, opening through which one had a free view into another region, which was more enlightened. Close quote. William Herschel says of this opening in the sky, quote, if its diameter at this distance subtend an angle of 10 degrees, which it nearly does, its magnitude must be utterly inconceivable. It has been calculated that it must be 2 trillions of times the dimensions of the sun, close quote. Lighter than the sun. Thomas Dick, the philosopher, thus speaks of this luminous nebula. Quote, we were placed as near it as one half the distance of the nearest star, great as that distance is. From such a point, it would exhibit an effulgence approximately to that of the sun, and to beings as much nearer distance it would fill a large portion of the sky and appear with a splendor inexpressible. But the ultimate design of such an object in all its bearings and relations may perhaps remain to be evolved during the future ages of an interminable existence, and like many other objects in the distant spaces of creation, it excites in the mind a longing desire to behold the splendid and mysterious scenes of the universe a little more unfolded. Close quote. Dick's Sidereal Heavens, page 96. Elder Bates, in concluding an article upon the subject, said, quote, thus we see from all the testimony adduced, and we could give much more were it necessary, that here is a most wonderful and unexplainable phenomena in the heavens, a gap in the sky more than 11,314,000 miles in circumference. Says the celebrated Huygens, I never saw anything like it among the rest of the fixed stars, a free view into another region more enlightened. Close quote. Another testimony on the planet vision. Again we quote from Mrs. Truesdale, who was present on the occasion of the giving of the vision referred to. She says, quote, Sister White was in very feeble health, and while prayers were offered in her behalf, the Spirit of God rested upon us. We soon noticed that she was insensible to earthly things. This was her first view of the planetary world. After counting aloud the moons of Jupiter, and soon after those of Saturn, she gave a beautiful description of the rings of the latter. She then said, the inhabitants are a tall, majestic people, so unlike the inhabitants of Earth. Sin has never entered there. It was evident from Brother Bates's smiling face that his past doubts in regard to the source of her visions were fast leaving him. We all knew that Captain Bates was a great lover of astronomy, as he would often locate many of the heavenly bodies for our instruction. When Sister White replied to his questions after the vision, saying that she had never studied or otherwise received knowledge in this direction, he was filled with joy and happiness. He praised God and expressed his belief that this vision concerning the planets was given that he might never doubt again. This is a close quote, and it is from Mrs. Trudell's letter of January 27, 1891. A vicious horse suddenly tamed. Shortly after this meeting in Topsham, another striking incident occurred in connection with the visions, which I will relate as told me by Elder Bates. Elder White had the use of a partly broken colt and a two-seated market wagon, which was constructed without a dashboard, but had a step across the front of the wagon and an iron step from the shafts. It was necessary that extreme care be taken in driving the colt, as in case the lines or anything touched his flanks, he would instantly kick furiously, and he had to be held in continually with a taut rein to keep him from running. This colt belonged to a party to whose place they wished to go, and as Elder White had been used to managing unbroken colts, he thought he would have no serious trouble with this one. Had they known, however, that during its frantic demonstrations it had previously killed two men, one by crushing him against the rocks by the roadside, he might have been less confident. On this occasion, there were four persons in the wagon, Elder White and his wife upon the front seat, and Elder Bates and Israel Damon on the back seat. While Elder White was giving his utmost care to keep the horse under control, Mrs. White was conversing about the truth when the power of God came down upon the company, and she was taken off in vision, seated in the wagon. The moment she shouted, "Glory," as she went into vision, the colt suddenly stopped perfectly still and dropped his head. At the same time, Mrs. White arose while in this state, and with her eyes looking upward, stepped over the front of the wagon, down onto the shafts, with her hands on the colt's haunches. Elder Bates called out to Elder White, "The colt will kick that woman to death." Elder White replied, "The Lord has the colt in charge now. I do not wish to interfere." The colt stood as gentle as an old horse. By the roadside, the bank rose up some 6 feet, and next to the fence was a grassy place. Mrs. White, with her eyes still upward, not once looking down, went up the bank onto the grassy plot, then walked back and forth for a few minutes, talking and describing the beauties of the new earth. Then, with her head in the same posture, she came down the bank, walked up to the wagon, stepped up onto the steps with her hand on the rump of the colt, and so up onto the shafts and into the wagon again. The moment she sat down upon the seat, she came out of vision, and that instant the horse, without any indication from the driver, started up and went on his way. While Mrs. White was out of the wagon, Elder White thought he would test the horse and see if he was really tame or not. At first, he just touched him with the whip. At other times, the horse would have responded with a kick. But now there was no motion. He then struck him quite a blow, then harder and still harder. The colt paid no attention to the blows whatever, but seemed as harmless as the lions whose mouths the angels shut the night Daniel spent in their den. "It was a solemn place," said Elder Bates, "and it was evident that the same power that produced the visions for the time being subdued the wild nature of the colt. If this vision was simply the result of some of her bodily infirmities, the query naturally arises, was the horse afflicted in like manner?" Israel Damon's testimony. I will give here, as corroborating the account given me by Elder Bates, the following statement. Quote, "About 20 years ago, just after I had commenced the observance of the Sabbath, Israel Damon related to me the circumstances of Sister White's having the vision while he, Elder Bates, and Elder White and his wife were riding in the light wagon behind the refractory colt. I have today read the above description of the occurrence as written out by Elder Loughborough, and it agrees precisely with what Elder Damon told me." Close quote, signed R.S. Weber, Battle Creek, Michigan, February 9, 1891. Elder Bates' testimony on the visions. Elder Bates states his own experience thus, quote, "Although I could see nothing in them that militated against the word, yet I felt alarmed and tried exceedingly and for a long time unwilling to believe that it was anything more than what was produced by a protracted, debilitated state of her body. I therefore sought opportunities in presence of others when her mind seemed free from excitement, out of meeting, to question and cross-question her and her friends who accompanied her, especially her elder sister, to get, if possible, at the truth. During the number of visits she has made to New Bedford and Fairhaven since, while at our meetings, I have seen her in vision a number of times, and also in Topshen, Maine, and those who were present during some of those exciting scenes know well with what interest and intensity I listened to every word and watched every move to detect deception or mesmeric influence. And I thank God for the opportunity I have had with others to witness these things. I can now confidently speak for myself. I believe the work is of God and is given to comfort and strengthen his scattered, torn, and peeled people since the closing up of our work in October of 1844. The distracted states of low here's and low there's since that time has exceedingly perplexed God's honest, willing people and made it exceedingly difficult for such as were not able to expound the many conflicting texts that have been presented to their view. I confess that I have received light and instruction on many passages that I could not before clearly understand. I believe her to be a self-sacrificing, honest, willing child of God." Close quote from A Word to the Little Flock, page 21. The author does not obtain the sentiments of her visions from previous teachings or study. When she received her first vision in December of 1844, she and all the band in Portland, Maine, where her parents then resided, had given up on the midnight cry as being in the past. It was then that the Lord showed her in vision the air into which she and the band in Portland had fallen. She then related her vision to the band, and they acknowledged their seventh-month experience to be the work of God. This is quoted from A Word to the Little Flock, page 22. How the three messages were regarded in 1847. The following from Elder James White, written in April of 1847, will show how the three messages were then regarded. Quote, "All classes of Second Advent believers agree that the angel brought to view in the sixth and seventh verses of this chapter, Revelation 14, represents the Advent message to the church and world. The work of the second angel was to show to the Advent host that Babylon had fallen. And as a large portion of them did not learn this fact until the power of the midnight cry waked them up just in time for them to make their escape from the churches before the tenth day came, it follows that since the seventh month, 1844, the third angel's message was, and still is, a warning to the saints to hold fast and not go back and receive the marks which the Virgin Band got rid of during the second angel's cry. And has not the true message for God's people since the seventh month, 1844, been just such a warning? It certainly has. The 12th verse reads, "Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus." Where did you see them, John? Why, here, during the third angel's message, as the patient waiting time has been since the seventh month, 1844, and as the class that keep the Sabbath, etc., have appeared since that time, it is plain that we live in the time of the third angel's message. Close quote. A Word to the Little Flock, pages 10 and 11, Brunswick, Maine, May 1847. This is the end of chapter 16.